We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is Amy Poehler. My new movie, Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, is coming to theaters June 14th, and it's making me feel joy and sadness and anger, definitely some disgust,
Rose,
and I think a little fear.
Really?
But I'm also feeling these new emotions like anxiety, embarrassment, envy, and ennui.
It's what you call the boredom.
Okay, that one was weird. It's going to be the feel-everything movie of the summer. Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, only in theaters June 14th. Get tickets now.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, everyone. I am Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. Perpetual Chess is a weekly chess interview show where we talk with accomplished chess players, authors, and personalities about their lives, their careers, and how to improve at chess. Perpetual Chess is brought to you through the generosity of its Patreon and PayPal supporters and by Chessable.com. Hey everyone, welcome back to Perpetual Chess. We have a guest I am excited to talk about adult improvement and other matters. He is a Singapore-based grandmaster. He is also the CFO at Lucent, which is an oncology company. And he is really an adult improver, as he made the GM title this year at the old in air quotes, age of 36. So very excited to talk about that long journey. He's also an author. In 2014, he wrote a book called Chess Developments, The Sicilian Nydorf. He's a renowned opening theoretician, as that book might suggest and as his reputation suggests. So we'll probably talk about some openings a little bit. He's also been doing some admirable charity initiatives, such as Chess Against COVID charity initiative. He's been organizing some events, and the seven-time Singapore champion. And I think that's about everything. So let's bring him in. Kevin Goh, how are you?
Hi, Ben. Thanks for the extremely generous introduction.
How did I do? Did I miss any major biographical bullet points, Kevin?
No, you probably covered pretty much everything. And yeah, extremely complimentary, of course.
Oh, good. Well, yeah, I'm excited to chat, about chess improvement, but also about your life and career generally. But one thing we were just talking about before we pressed record is obviously we were talking about how chess is doing pretty well right now. And you mentioned that in your native Singapore in particular, you feel like chess is gaining popularity. What's happening on the ground in Singapore?
Yeah, I think that due to COVID-19 in the last couple of months, the Singapore government has introduced what we term as a circuit breaker. It is a fanciful term to describe some COVID-19 measures to sort of flatten the curve, as what people like to say. So for one, working from home is kind of mandatory unless you're in essential services. There are no sports events in Singapore as well as globally. And thankfully, because because of the internet, that, you know, we could do a lot of events online. And that was how the Chess Against COVID came about. So I was extremely fortunate that I made the GM title. In fact, FIDE gave me the title on the 1st of April, and that was just before everything went crazy and there was a travel lockdown. So thanks to this, the perfect timing, the media got in touch. And in conjunction with the charity, we sort of got quite a fair bit of coverage in the last couple of months. So that was really fortunate for Chess.
Yeah, and I mean, of course, we're all grateful that your help giving Chess a good name by organizing these initiatives. So I know you did the Singapore against New York match, and I think you've done one or two other events as well. But could you tell us a little bit about like how the idea for that came about and how you went about organizing it?
Yeah, so the idea of having a series of just online chess initiatives came from a friend of mine. His name is Junior Tay. And we were just saying that, okay, now that chess events are being canceled all over the world, we can't have training, we can't do anything face-to-face. So we might as well do some online stuff and just to keep the chess community in Singapore connected. So the ideas of having some simuls, maybe some lectures and, you know, just some events to keep the chess players entertained came about. And we very quickly formed a team of volunteers to sort of put all this together. Initially, the idea was just to, you know, do some chess stuff for chess players and to keep it light, maybe one event, one or two events every weekend. And then Olympia Khan, you know, came up with the ingenious idea of doing this for charity because it sort of makes sense. And then the whole thing just exploded. We have a lot of volunteers coming forward, young players from the age of 10, all the way to the age of 60 plus, you know, players coming out of retirement, offering to spend their time for the chess community. And it was great that everything worked out. And we raised a total of about 170,000 Singapore dollars. So I'm not sure how much that is in US. It's probably about 150 around there.
Wow.
So I think none of us ever expected anything like this. And the media were extremely interested as well. So yeah, I think COVID-19 was bad and unfortunate for everyone. But at least in chess, it was a good thing that we could at least leverage the fact that we could play chess on the internet.
Yeah, it is great to see. And when I interviewed GM Rustam Kazimzhanov right when COVID was hitting, one of the things he mentioned, and we were just starting to talk about sort of the online boom, and he was saying that he sort of wished that, he thought that the fact that chess was putting on these events was great, but he was a little worried that, he was saying it would be nice if we did some charity things too. So it's nice to see that you pick up the baton and push these initiatives forward and raise so much money. That's awesome. But I wanted to follow up on one thing because you mentioned your friend Olympior Khan, who I think a lot of listeners who are on Chess Twitter will know. I mean, he's got a large following and a great Patreon page, and I always enjoy his contributions to the online chess discourse. But I, of course, haven't met him in person. We've had some nice online interactions, and I think a lot of people feel that way. And I know you're friendly with him. So tell us a little bit more about Olympio. What's he like in real life?
Yeah, I should get paid for this because he's kind of a mysterious guy. He's really, you know, he's really low profile. He doesn't really like to he doesn't have too many friends. I think that's a fair comment to say, and that's because he chooses his friends very carefully.
But you made the cut.
It was the GM title helped. but really, I think that he's of course has a great knowledge of chess history. I think he's one of the most famous chess historians in the world, and I shouldn't give away anything, but he's working on a really serious project, and he just shared the more details about this project with me a couple of hours ago. And it's something really exciting, and I hope that he announces it soon. But yeah, a guy that is really passionate about chess, great friend and actually really funny guy, as you can see from his Twitter account.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, because he seems, I mean, I don't want to hijack the interview and talk about Olympio the whole time.
We can talk about Olympio for an hour.
And I should say, I'm probably, you know, if Olympio is willing, he'll be on the show sometime, probably around when the large project you mentioned is coming out. At least if I have anything to do with it, he will. But yeah, I mean, because he's so serious about chess history. And like you say, renowned, rightfully so, knows so much about it. But then every once in a while, he'll sprinkle in like some sort of like old school hip hop reference or some sort of comedy thing. So it's like, he seems like super serious. And like you say, like sometimes he gets in arguments with people. He's not afraid to do that. But then there's also obviously a light side. So anyway, we'll unravel the mystery of Olympio more in due time. But let's get back to your career. So obviously, I mean, there's a lot we can talk about. You're having been the 7-time champion of Singapore. But I mean, to me, and I think to a lot of listeners, the most fascinating thing about your career is this epic journey to get the Grandmaster title. So it looks like you got your first Norms in 2011 and 2012, and then got the third Norm in 2018, and then finally got the last few rating points this year. So take us through that journey. Like, how long has it been where you've said to yourself, I'm going to get the GM title? Like, was it as soon as you got the IM title, or was there a moment where it had to start to seem possible after that?
Yeah, this could take really long, but I remember that when I made the IM title, I think that was in 2007. I sort of feel that the gap between IM and GM is really large, and I just felt I wasn't confident enough. I didn't think that I have the ability to get there, and I sort of thought that that's it. You know, IM is good enough. I'm happy. You know, there's not that many IMs in Singapore, but it's a pretty good, it's pretty decent level. Let's put it this way. And I focus on my career. Singapore is a pretty expensive place to live in. Right. So at some point, I think I was listening to, I think it was John Bartholomew, who was saying that if you want to take time off to become a GM, it's not the same as trying to become an FM or an IM. Becoming a GM is a lot more serious. It's a bit hard to explain why, but it's just that the gap in terms of the knowledge between a grandmaster and an IM is really, the difference is really something that is far greater than, say, the previous other levels in chess. So at the point, I didn't think that I could commit to that. I couldn't commit the time to spend reading up, to train, and on top of that, to make a career for myself. So I sort of, you know, hovered, drifted around, you know, just playing some chess here and there, looking at some chess, and then playing in some Olympiads, but never really improving. And I wasn't overly concerned. And until in 2010, I was sort of omitted from the Olympiad squad. And at the time, I felt it was unjustified because I had won the Singapore National Championships 4 years in a row before that.
Yeah, you could say that.
Yeah, I was national champion from 2006 to 2009, and in 2010, I finished third. And the selection committee basically said that only the top two places get a spot, and then they are free to choose anyone else. So they conveniently omitted me from the team. And I remember that I was just really devastated, because playing for the country is something that that I felt was really important to me. I take it as a badge of honor, and I try to play my best every time. And I remember that I was at work, and I semi broke down, you know, in the middle of the office, and that was the time when I sort of recollected, and I sort of, you know, I spoke to myself. I did a lot of soul searching at a point in time, you know, and I just felt that, okay, well, what did I really do to deserve a place in the Olympiad just because I'm number three in the country? But I haven't done anything, right? In the last few years, I sort of just stagnated. I didn't really do anything to prove that I deserve to play for the country. So, and that was the point when I decided that perhaps I should take a year off from work and see how far I can go. And it all started from there. So that was 2010. That was late 2010. I spoke to my company. That's KPMG Singapore. It's one of the biggest accounting firms in the world. And they were very kind and generous. So they basically said that you get your job once you come back. You can take a year off. That's fine. We wish you all the best. And I didn't really have any expectations. But what was important is that I had to have a strategy, because I think around the time I was about 29, I'm kind of old to try to become a GM.
Sad but true.
And my rating is not even that high. I was about 2390 or something.
Oh, wow. Ways to go. Yeah.
Huge gap to try.
Yeah, so
to
he needed
there.
Just for any listeners who don't know, you need 2500 FIDE in addition to the three norms. Sorry, but go on.
Yeah, that's right. So my thought is I will give it a shot. I'll take 1 year. I see how far I can go. If I'm just miles off, I'll just quit. I'll just go back to work, because at some point you have to be responsible as well. You need to be responsible to those around you, and you can't just pursue a dream without caring about anything else. So I had a plan. I had a regime crafted out in 2011. Basically it was 8 hours of training every single day, starting from 8 a.m. I wake up, I go for a run. So I'm not going to bore you with all the details, but
no, that's this whole show is boring us with the details. We got to hear everything you did, and then hope that if we do it, we'll be grandmasters too. So tell us more about your routine during this period.
Yeah. Basically I woke up at 8 a.m. every single day. I go for 1 hour run. I have breakfast, and then I solve 2 hours of puzzles. So calculation, studies, or just tactics. And I was using Perfect Your Chess. I think this is a very popular book. I think many people should know of this. Yeah, I think.
Yeah, people, often recommended. Yeah. Very high level, challenging puzzles, but great.
Extremely tough. And I had a lot of fun working on those. And then the rest of the day is dedicated to opening preparation. So
wow.
Essentially 5 to 6 hours minimum, and some days I go up to 10 hours. And I sometimes wonder, like, how do I keep this motivation going? And I think it's really firstly it's the anger, really the disappointment of not being selected, and then secondly it's like I wanted to prove a point to myself and see if I'm taking a year off, then I shouldn't be spending time watching Netflix in the morning and then going to the gym and having fun with friends. That just doesn't make any sense, because I'm suffering financially. I didn't have any a big corporate sponsor. I do have some help from friends. I think Junior is one of them, as I mentioned, my good friend. And Olympio is supportive in his own way. But financially, it was a big hit. So it doesn't make any sense. If you want to go all in, you go all in. And there's no reason to skive on the job, so to speak.
Yeah.
So, and then in terms of tournament schedules, I had the idea of playing two events and then regroup, train for 1 month, identify the errors and the weaknesses, and then play another two events. And so in that entire year, if you average that out, I played about 12 events, I think. So what surprised me was the first tournament that I played was the Budapest First Saturday GM event. And I was, and after four games, I had 2 out of 4. I felt really miserable. I had no friends. And that was where I met another one of your, a guest of yours. I think Eric Kislik. I became friends with him there. But yeah, I was already semi-regretting doing it. And then I won 3 games in a row, and I needed 2 out of 2 in the last 2 games, and I scored 1.5. So in the end, I was just a half point short. So my first tournament in the GM event, and I was half a point short, and that really encouraged me. At the same time, I was also really disappointed to come so close. But life is as such. But the really positive thing that happened was what happened next. And I made my first GM nom immediately in the second tournament. That was in Kashkemet, which is sort of a sister event to the Budapest First Saturday series. And those events are not easy at all. And I had the fortune of playing and meeting the legend Gyula Sachs, who unfortunately had passed away recently. But he was... I won a really important game against him, one of my best games to date. It was in the French defense, and he was very generous with his comments as well. So I made my first GM nom, and from then on, I knew that I'm never going to stop because I made my first GM nom. So obviously, there are some points when you feel it is possible to have flukes here in once in a while, but people try not to think about that. You always think that you have gotten here once, and you would like to think that you can get there again. So that was how it all began.
Yeah, well, I mean, certainly it's a good sign that you only missed by half a point in the first event and then got it in the second event. But before we retrace that journey a little bit, I just wanted to get a little more context of what your chess background was before you took this step. So, because I'm just curious, when did you start chess, and what was it that gave you the belief that you still had more at an age and a career circumstance when a lot of people would just kind of put it on the back burner?
Yeah, I started learning chess at the age of 10, and in my first tournament, I finished third. I think that was the Nationals under 10. So that encouraged me, and I think I'm just really competitive, and for some reason chess just made me really fascinated. There was one incident when I was really young. I think I was 11, when I crept down. So I was supposed to be asleep. There was school the next day, and I literally at midnight I crept downstairs and I set up a position on the dining table, a position which I couldn't solve during the day, and I was so annoyed that I couldn't solve it, that I actually had to, stealthily creep downstairs just to do it. And my mom caught me in the act, and surprisingly, she let me solve the puzzle. Like, she just said, okay, how long do you need? So I think it was, chess just got me really fascinated. There's just so many elements to the game. And I think it's also partially to do with the fact that I read the right stuff at a young age. It was not just about trying to win every single game. It was also about reading the right materials to get you fascinated with the different aspects. So, for instance, I really love the book Secrets of Spectacular Chess. Not the most famous book in the world, but I got to know more about chess studies from that book.
Do you remember the author? I'll look it up. But meanwhile, I actually had first of all, I need to know, did you solve the study? When
I did.
How long did it take you from when your mom came down?
Half an hour.
Okay, that's not too bad. It's amazing how many strong players like yourself have that character. There's something about people who make it to your level that they just can't give up. Like, that combination of competitiveness and doggedness seems to be a pretty common trait amongst grandmasters.
Yeah, I think for me, it was really about chess. I am not really competitive in other areas. Like in studies, I didn't think about I wanted to be a top student in my class. So it could be just about chess and the fact that I'm just fascinated. I remember that when I was in school, I would make a list of the players that I've beaten. And if I've beaten them, I never want to play them again. So I will make another list of the players who I've lost to, and I really want to beat them. So it's like the Arya Stark list in Game of Thrones, that the guys that you really want to kill. So it was actually like that. It was literally, I literally wrote down a list of names that I wanted to beat. So I was really competitive at a very young age, and I still have that even now.
Huh. Okay. So Secrets of Spectacular Chess by Jonathan Lovett and David.
Yes, that's right. Jonathan Lovett and David Freigood. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. So, but the age of 10, that really is, these days, I mean, it's kind of depressing to say, but it's kind of a late start. So,
you're supposed to be a GM, by now.
So I can, but true, I can see how you felt like you had more. So let's bring it back to the period where you're training hardest. So what made you decide? I mean, you've got a reputation as an opening theoretician, which hearing you say that you studied it for 6 hours a day, we know why. So was that, did you think that that was the best use of optimizing your results, or was that just where your biggest interest in chess lied? Why did you decide to allocate your time that way?
I think that definitely studying openings is one of my biggest interests. I have a lot of fun researching lines and doing my own investigations, looking at books and you know, just being academic about it. But at the same time, I also think that it is the most practical thing to do at my age.
Right.
So basically, I was never going to be one of the top 50 players in the world, let's put it like that, at my age. There's no way, because I just didn't have the kind of chess culture, the foundation that the Russians or the Chinese or the Indian players have, or the Europeans who train at a young age. I just didn't have that kind of training when I was young. So it was just not realistic to aim to become, say, a 2650. So my target was to become a GM, and that given, again, I have to emphasize that the age factor, because it is not trivial at all that I was approaching 30, and that you need to find an equalizer somewhere that sort of balances things up. The fact that you just don't have the same kind of physical fitness, the same kind of concentration. You have other responsibilities to worry over. You need to worry about money. So in your approach to chess, if you want to become a GM, you just need to be, you know, more practical. And my approach was to just be very, very tricky in my choice of my openings and to be extremely unpredictable.
Huh.
Yeah.
So that means you need to know everything.
Yeah. And the fact that I played in the two close GM events and that I had the list of players, in fact, everybody had the list of players beforehand, gave me a significant edge because I could actually prepare against these guys beforehand. So the pairings were drawn just one day before, but I could prepare both colors. So on the flight to Budapest, I had my openings mapped out for both colors against every single opponent. I mean, I cannot account for things like change in players. I mean, that we can't do anything about that. But I have an idea what to do against every single player in the field. And I think that if you are really serious about making a result, if you are really dedicated and you have the time for it, there's no excuse not preparing for this before the tournament. There's just no excuse because you have the information in hand, you should use it. And that was my way, that was how I sort of equalized in that sense that I have to catch up, but I'm never going to have the time to look at Karpov's best games or Petrosian's best games and, you know, try to catch up in terms of that aspect. But I can look at the guy's openings and try to figure out where his weaknesses are, and then I come up with a couple of surprises for him and hope that it works. So that was my strategy at the time.
So would it be more like a stylistic weakness or an actual repertoire hole?
So I try not to look for one-off lines, because I feel that at some point in time, you should still have a repertoire that can last you for a lifetime. But unless I ran out of ideas at that point in time, I generally would try to look for something that can last, that I can use for a longer period of time. So what I do is sometimes I also look at my own games online, and I try to think, which is what I think a lot of players do as well. You look at your own games and you think what the other guy might be playing, which is why I think that it's really important to have a wide repertoire if you're playing for the GM title, because it just makes preparation a lot more difficult. For instance, if you just play E4, it's just a lot more easier. But if you play both E4, D4, and C4, Knight F3, you know, I have a friend, Daniel Fernandez, grandmaster, yeah, from the United Kingdom. He plays like 9 different first moves, I think, with white. So it's just really useful and practical.
Yeah, that makes sense. So you got these two norms pretty quickly, 2011 and 2012. But I saw that you mentioned in an interview that then you took time off from chess.
Yeah, that was just idiocy and just. I mean, you cannot justify such a reason, except for the fact that I was desperately trying to get promoted.
Okay.
Because I left my job for a year and I was trying to catch up with my peers. So, but there was just no excuse because not only was I not playing, I was also not training. So there's just no excuse for that. And it was just complacency because I felt that I made my second GM norm and it was in good style. I made my GM norm in China at the Asian Team Championships, beating the Chinese number two player. So at the time, I was really complacent, and that was a mistake that I regret to this day. What I should have done is I should have planned, like I have always done. I should have planned for a strategy, to choose certain events, to plan a schedule that allows me to train for these events, as well as to not compromise or jeopardize my chances of promotion. So
you did have to go back to work. There was no avoiding that, right?
I didn't have a choice, I think.
Yeah.
Which I think is fair enough. I think everybody has to make a living, and making chess from a living is possible in Singapore. It's just a lot more uncertain, given the fact that you're kind of relying on students, or that making money from tournaments is really difficult. And pursuing my career at KPMG just makes a lot more sense at the time.
Yeah, especially, I mean, you have a good career, it seems. I mean,
yeah, it's a pretty decent career, and I eventually left the firm to pursue accounting in the commercial world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess that in 2013 I didn't play any standard chess events, I believe. And then in 2014 I played in the Tromso, I believe that's the Tromso Olympiad. No, or was it 2016? I kind of have a... No, 2014 was the Tromso Olympiad, I believe. And then I came really close to a GM norm. In fact, I think I needed a draw against a Peruvian grandmaster, I think Cordova. And I couldn't make the draw. And then that adds on to the complacency because I thought that I didn't train for a year and hence... I could still come so close. It probably means I am at the grandmaster level. But spoiler alert, there's no such thing as a grandmaster level. Either you are a grandmaster or you are not.
Right.
So I hear, you know, a lot of my friends are always saying, this guy is going to become a GM. And even if he doesn't, he should be a GM if he puts his time to it. There's no such thing. Like it's either you are a GM or you are not. Because it's not just about knowledge, it's not about talent, it's also about the ability to handle your nerves, your composure against tougher opponents as compared to IM events.
Yeah, can I actually read a quote? So you mentioned your friend Junior Tay a couple times. I found an interview that he did with you for Chess Base India, which I believe was right after you got your third norm, 2018. You mentioning the pressure, you said, I always have a lot of pressure when I'm playing in GM events, given the fact that I already have two norms and that I've come close on several other occasions. This event was extra special to me because I was playing in my home country and it really would have meant something if I could turn in a good result. It got really bad after round four when I was sitting on +2 and I was going to have two whites on the next day, knowing I needed to score at least one win in order to keep the momentum going. I didn't manage the stress very well and could only sleep at 2 a.m. despite feeling really tired from all the preparatory work. Thankfully, somehow it all came together in the end. But yeah, that's something that, I mean, I feel like I love chess. I love the culture. I love the history. But there's a tendency to glamorize the competitive aspect when it can be so nerve-wracking. So what was that like, that process and the feeling of months of preparation, and then you go and it all comes down to this tournament that you've traveled, you know, and this one was at home, but a lot of tournaments you're flying for many hours to get to. Like, how do you manage that?
I don't.
Yeah.
I don't. I honestly don't. The fact that I made GM 8 years after I made my second norm, it proves that I was not able to manage the stress as well as I could. And I think that the financial stress especially is really high. I'm fortunate that I have a sort of a stable job and I could afford to pay the bills. But it is still cost. You spend time away, the time that you could spend with your family, time you could spend on being better at your job. And that sort of thing weighs in. And as when you board the flight, all these things come together. You just, okay, here we go again. You know, is it going to be the same old story? Am I going to come back, you know, worse off? And that's the thing, right? Like you could come back with a huge rating loss if everything goes south. So I had conversations with many trainers about this, like how to manage this aspect. How do you not choke when you are in the clutch game, when you need a draw, when you need a win? And I was told that the more encounters you have, the more experienced you would be and the better you'll be. You'll be able to manage this. It helps if the financial stress is taken away from you.
Yeah.
That definitely helps because that's one less thing to worry about. But at the same time, the risk is that you get relaxed too early. So you think that this event, if I messed up in round two, it's okay, I have the next event to go to. Right? So that could be a counteract to that. But I would say with all things considered, I would still prefer to have, you know, the money to support this traveling. And also I think coming from Asia is sort of challenging from a practical aspect because there are just not enough tournaments in Asia.
Right.
And you can't really spend like 2 months away from home in Europe. It's just not feasible. Like you can't just leave your family for 2 months. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. So, did you have a wife and kids at this time or no?
Yes, I was already married by the time. Yes.
Oh yeah, that makes it. I mean, in a yeah, that doesn't. I don't know. Probably overall, it doesn't help. Although it does help to have support. So it's not, you know, like to feel loved and like at least have that aspect of your life somewhat stable. Yeah. Can be good as well. So.
Yeah, definitely. I think I was really fortunate that my family members have always been extremely supportive. At some point in time, there will be somebody who comes and tell you that you should just focus on, you know, being good at your job and making a good living and stop pursuing this dream that doesn't get you anywhere. Because at the end, so what if you get a GM title? You
know, right. Yeah.
So that's the. I'm not sure about how it's like in the US, but in Singapore, nobody does this sort of thing. Right? Nobody. Right.
Gives you an extra motivation because you were the first grandmaster in Singapore for what, 2 decades or something like that?
Yes, 21 years.
Yeah. So, I mean, at least that gives you, because like when I talked to, there was a guy I interviewed recently, I.M. Kare Christensen, who earned the title of I.M. in his 50s. And wow. For someone like, which is amazing. Yeah, it's incredible.
Yeah, it's amazing, yeah.
But for someone like that, I mean, he's not trying to set an example for his country or something. Like, at least you're one of the strongest players in your country. And obviously, all due respect to Kare. It's amazing what he did. And he works and has a family as well. But for him, it's like it has to be even more internally driven because, as you mentioned, at least you had a few people supporting you. And you know, you're going to the Olympiads, which, you know, every chess player dreams of. So you've got some feedback that like positive feedback and some external motivation, as opposed to it being like 100% internal driven, which is where a lot of chess players, get their motivation.
Yeah. I don't know about that really. Like, I think that first and foremost, I will make it categorically clear that my motivation to become a GM is, I would say 90% is purely self-driven. I would say that it is not because I'm doing it for the sake of, you know, my supporters or or to show that. So how should I put it? I'm not going to be hypocritical about this and, you know, to try to pretend that I'm something more than I'm not. but it is mainly because I want to make a point and to prove to myself that I can do it. And fortunately, I was able to. And the fact that I could inspire other chess players is, and I could help to guide them along in their own journeys is sort of a plus point. But that is not the main motivation. So I will be completely honest about this, that I want to see that, I want to try to become a GM and to be able to prove it. So that was my core motivation, and the fact that that people are inspired by it. Obviously, I'm really touched and happy with the many comments that I'm something like a role model and that sort of. But I wasn't really trying to be something like that, to be honest. But the fact that I could now guide these players along is something of a bonus for me. So
yeah. So that's. Yeah, I mean, you did mention how competitive you are. So it makes sense. So you get the final norm in 2018, the third norm, but you still need the rating requirement. So you needed to reach 2,500. So how did it feel? I mean, it must have been sort of bittersweet. Like, how far away? And you just earned it 2 years, 1.5 years later, or whatever it is, you made it to 2,500 FIDE. So what was the feeling in 2018 when you got the third norm, but you still have this little bit of a hill to climb?
Yeah, it was the same old story. Complacency set in, and I just thought it was done. I was 24.93, and I thought that I would play some open events. I would try to win my first three to four games, and I'll make it, and then I'll just relax. And yeah, it was complacency. I'm not shying away from the fact. The next event.
We're all human. I mean, you know, I think it's a natural reaction.
Yeah, I just thought that I'm going to do it, and once again, I slackened and I didn't really train as hard as I could have. And I rashly signed up to play the Malaysian Open. And I played a very good player in round one. His rating is about 2,000, but he's actually a pretty decent player. His name is Suman. I think he's a really decent player. He's capable of pulling off upsets. And yeah, I just lost. And,
wow. And so how many points do you lose for that?
9.1 is maxed. Okay. It's maxed out. So I lost that one. I made a draw with a 21-42 in round three. And then I lost to a 2,100 player, I think, in round four. And then I withdrew from the event. I just couldn't believe. And it was the first time I ever withdrawn from an event, but I thought that was the right time. And I lost 21 rating points. Jeez. In four games.
Yeah, which FIDE, it's a compressed scale at your level. I think a lot of U.S. chess players are used to like bigger swings, but that's huge at your level. I mean, that's devastating.
That is insane. I mean, 31 points in four games is just insane. It could have been worse if I have continued the tournament. But yeah, I think that was a really big shock. And then suddenly from 7 points, I was down 28 points. And the GM title seemed even further away at that point in time. So yeah, I honestly didn't know what to say, what to think. I couldn't sleep for a few nights, and things didn't get better. I played in a couple of other events, and then I continued to bleed, and at some point was my rating was 2465. So
jeez,
35 points. Yeah, from 7 to 35 is it's just, I think I read about a similar player, a player who had a similar encounter as well. I think Ashwin Jayaram, I think the Indian grandmaster, I think he's based in the US now.
Yeah, I know
the
name.
He also said, yeah, he said something like that as well. I think he had something of collapse, very similar to mine.
Man.
So that was 2018, 2019. And then I'm such a huge distance away, and once again, I came back to the point to strategize in a better manner. So no signing up of events if I'm not able to train. And then by the time I was already hired with Lucens, and my CEO, who has always been really supportive, kind of thought that I was a GM in 2018 until I broke the news that actually I'm not.
By the way,
then I,
You know, it's been going on for a long time because I have a friend who got all the IAM norms and then he kind of quit chess. Shout out to my friend Donnie Ariel, who maybe recapping a book with me soon on the podcast. Is there a name for that when you've earned the norms but you don't have the title? That's not like GM elect, is it?
That you could say that, yes. GM elect, IAM elect.
Okay.
But it's not an official term.
I know that for years.
It's a really sad title to have, to be honest. I'd much rather be a GM than to be a GM elect.
Yeah.
And I think that was those days that, you know, there's so many doubts in my head, so many uncertainties. I have a really difficult, challenging job with Lucens, who was one of the fastest growing startups in Singapore. And I was heavily involved in things like fundraising as well as growing the company. So taking leave to go for chess is just not an option. And yeah, my boss was really kind, and we sort of made a deal that once we are done with the next round of funding, if I manage to close it by a certain period of time, I could take a month off for tournaments. So that was a deal I had with him.
Does that mean you're studying the whole time, like waiting for that moment when you can actually go play? Or are you like,
yeah.
Wow.
So to put it into the concrete details, so when I was conversing with my counterpart from the investor side, we were discussing when should we close the deal and when the money should come in. I'm not sure whether I should be disclosing this, but I gave a date somewhere in early October, and I was really insistent on the date. And then they were asking, like, they had no idea why, and I just said, oh, we had things to do in the later part of the year. There's, you know, just many things going on. And after that, I told them, sorry, guys, I have to go and play chess. And so I spent the rest of October and November training, and then I went to play in December. So that was the plan.
Were there specific events in December that you had in mind? Or
no.
Oh, okay.
No, as in chess tournaments. Yes, I had. So
right. Okay.
So those were tournaments in Serbia. And the good thing about these events that, okay, there are no prizes. They are closed GM events. They are not the most glamorous because, okay, it's not a fanciful city.
Right.
Not the best known events. But the nice thing is that the events are connected. So you get to play one after the other immediately. And the organizer is kind of sadist. So we played double rounds almost every single day. So there was a double, there was a, you know, for a 9-round event, it was single round, then double, 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 double. So that was like that for all three events. So I actually signed up for all three events. And the event the events turned out well for me.
That's great. And so you're back, finally you turn the mothership around, start getting rating points again, and then you finally got there this year, right?
Yeah, I think that I had a lot to thank Grandmaster Avitik Grigoryan, who I just known randomly on Facebook. Like, his advert just popped out on my Facebook, and I thought, okay, let me just give this guy a call and see if he's helping me. But before I go to that, I think I really should mention Grandmaster Boris Avruk, who was instrumental in my making my second Grandmaster norm. I think my first Grandmaster norm as well. Sorry to correct that. Yeah, so he actually helped me to throughout my entire journey since 2011, because I understood that I needed a coach, that working alone could work, but having a coach just increases your odds a lot more.
Yeah.
So I engaged Boris because back at the time, I think his books were really popular and his name was everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So he really helped me. I think even now, we're still sort of working together. And in 2019, just before the Serbian trip, I thought, okay, let me just work with somebody else as well, just to have a different perspective. And I really liked the way Avitik spoke, and he made his own personal ambition to help me become a GM.
That's great.
So we spent loads of hours, I think. easily 40, 50 hours in that one and a half months.
A website called Chessmood, right?
Chessmood.com. Yeah, that's the website that I actually honestly highly recommend, not just because he's my coach, but because I think the materials there are really valuable. I think that there's a lot to learn about, not just openings, I think in terms of meter games, concepts, and the follow-up stuff that he does, the webinars and the forum that he does. He's really engaging and he puts in 120%.
Yeah.
So just a quick plug for him. He should pay me for this, but... Avitik was a core reason, because not only did he really train me and work really hard with me. I think he really believed in me, and he gave me a lot of confidence that I could do this. So there were so many times that I'm not sure whether he's just saying this to sort of brainwash me. But he kept saying that, okay, come on, you know, the fact that you could solve this position in this time means that you're 2,500. And then after you keep saying it over and over again, whether it's true or not doesn't matter anymore.
Right, yeah. No, it's important. You need people in your corner. And it probably was true. I mean, clearly it was true since you made it. So once you finally get there this year, what did that feel like?
Yeah, it felt like, honestly, I just felt relief. I'm not really sure happiness is the right word, but I remember that when I received the certificate from FIDE on the 1st of April, I was really moved, and I couldn't really do anything for a while, on the verge of tears.
Did it hit home more when you got the certificate than when you got the rating points?
Yeah, surprisingly, yes. Like when it was officially published on the 1st April list, and I saw the certificate. Yeah, I was really quite moved, and emotionally it touched me a lot harder than I thought. Yeah,
well, cool. But congratulations! I mean, it's an inspiration to a lot of people. So,
I think honestly, at the time when I won the game that gained me the final rating points, it was more of a relief than delight. So it was really weird, but I was more like, okay, it's done finally, you know.
And if you get it in the middle of a tournament, if you get a result that will put you over 2,500, is that good enough, or do you have to end the tournament over 2,500?
It is good enough. So it's good enough, but you need to get a certificate, some form of written document from the arbiter. There's no template for that, because I've tried looking for it, but there's but basically you need the arbiter to verify it. And the reason why this rule is really useful is because that there are some cases where I believe players were so for instance, my life rating is 2,500, and then I have a last round and I have to complete the tournament in order for this result to count, and my opponent will threaten not to show up unless I pay him. So there are cases like that. I've heard of so many cases like that from many friends. So I think this rule was really handy.
Huh. Yeah. Okay. So Kevin, again, amazing story. Congratulations. If you're up for it, we're not done. I'd like to pick your brain a little bit about Chess Improvement, but first, let's take a break and hear from our friends at Chessable. So in this interview, GM Kevin Goh mentions the importance of developing and maintaining a lifetime opening repertoire. Guess what? Chessable has many lifetime repertoire courses, as they're called, based on solid openings that you can maintain over your chess playing life. They include one by the Sky GM Jan Gustafsson on Double King Pawn, I am Christoph Zalecki on the Sveshnikov Sicilian, former US champion Sam Shanklin on the Semislav, and there are some big ones coming on the way for White as well. I've been studying a few of these courses myself, and I am enjoying and learning a lot from them. So if you want to just not remember lines, but learn and maintain opening ideas over time, Chessable.com can help you out. Okay, and we are back. So Kevin, I feel like you probably have a bit of unique perspective. I mean, most of the people listening, myself included, will never be grandmasters, but we're still hoping to get better with whatever time we have. So you probably don't have time to do a ton of training, but you probably at least understand the struggle more than like a super GM might. So what advice do you give? I'm sure you get asked all the time for chess improvement advice from club players. So What advice do you give to adult improving chess players?
I think that the first thing is to have a very clear goal. Some people like to set the ratings as a guideline. So I have many friends who say that they want to be 2,000 rated or they want to be 2,300 rated. And then seek advice as to whether that's a realistic goal or not. I think that's really important. I have some friends who came to me, they are like 1,800 and 35, and they asked me whether they could ever become GMs. And I just flat out, I just said no. There's just no chance, and it's not because of inability. It's just that that age will play against you. So it's just not possible. You will not be able to find the time, the energy, and the commitment to get on that task. And then we work from there. So for instance, if you want to be a 2,300 level player, say from 2,000, I would say that it's possible, but there are certain aspects that you need to work on. Then we start from the openings, we start from calculation. And I have a rather controversy opinion of my own, and is that I think the studying of the end games is completely irrelevant in this age.
I noticed when you said you studied that it was all calculation and openings. So that was by design?
Yeah, I'm pretty decent at end games, but I'm never going to be a huge expert at it. I'm interested in end games. I can watch Carsten Muller's end game shows all day long, but I would never invest the time that I could use for other aspects of my chess on say, Dovretsky Endgame Manual, which is, of course, a tremendously useful book. But putting things into context as a 29-year-old at the time, there's just no point looking at endgames. I think that's brushing up on openings, making sure that your calculation is spot on, that you're able to spot tactics fast, you don't blunder, and you keep up your physical fitness. I think those are more essential to getting good results. But if you are learning this from a young age, then obviously you have different goals. You might want to become a world champion or a 2,700 player, and of course you need to have that kind of foundation. So I think that's the first thing. That is my own opinion. I don't think there's ever a study being done for this, but I can share that a renowned Chinese GM shared the same views as me. So
interesting.
Yeah, that if you're in your 30s, forget end games.
That's funny because, I mean, since I ask someone almost every week for chess improvement advice, obviously I've gotten sort of the full spectrum of advice over the course of doing this. I would say it's in the minority that people single out end games as an important aspect, but it does happen. Like I remember when I talked to Grandmaster David Smerdon, who I believe you know, I think he's someone that mentioned endgames being important. What appeals to me about the, my personal chess, I'm like finally trying to get better again after some years just focusing on family and work. I've been thinking I'll do endgames, but it's never a priority. David Smerdon's argument was basically you save so many half points here and there between like converting a position that someone else might not convert or swindling someone. Are you not receptive to that argument, or you just think there are other half points to be saved by focusing on other aspects?
Yeah, I'm a good friend of David, actually. I really like the guy. I think he's a very strong player. He's also an amateur player, by the way. I think he's a university professor, I believe.
Yeah,
and I think it kind of boils down to style. So, firstly, he plays like his main line against the Sicilian is the C3 Sicilian.
Uh-oh. You're about to fire some shots. Like,
oh. Nothing against the C3 Sicilian, right. But you do get a fair bit of end games from that opening. I think you do get big attacks as well. But I think it's fair to say that it's generally a quieter approach as compared to open Sicilians. But I feel like if you want to make big rating gains in a short period of time, learning endgames is not the most practical use of time, because the game might not last that long. And And if you have a sound opening repertoire, or if you have a bad opening, let's talk about it conversely. If you have a bad opening repertoire, you won't even survive till then. And so there are just so many different perspectives. So if I'm playing, let's say, a young 16-year-old, so I actually have a very good example. I think in 2017, I played against a very young, promising German player. I think his name is Martin Julian or something like that. He's a really strong player and very well prepared, I think, in general. So for that game, I had an opening idea that he wasn't aware of. And the game was over, like straight from the opening. And could I have won that game with better endgame approach as compared to better openings? I highly doubt that, to be completely frank. So that one opening idea helped me win the game like in relatively easy. So that's I think that David has a fair point. That and one day I will regret this because I'm going to lose a slightly worse rook ending,
right?
Or I'm going to throw away a win in the promising position. But looking at my own games, I really don't have that many games where the end games are not clarified. So meaning to say that it's either that I reach an end game where I have a big advantage and I probably could convert it, or the other way around. So that's just my approach and my opinion to this.
Yeah, and I think you make some compelling arguments. Do you think that advice would extend like throughout the rating spectrum? Like I'm thinking of people rated below 1800, something like that. Do you think that people rated below 1800 also should be spending more time on openings and tactics, or is that more as you get higher that you think you have to focus on other things first?
So I'm presuming we are talking about adults. So for adult improvers, so I would say so, yes, because once again, as an adult, you just have other commitments. You have less time. Does studying? I'm not sure whether studying the Troyotsky. You're familiar with the Troyotsky, that Duna is against a pawn. Okay, that's not a fair example. But let's say rook and bishop against rook, for example. I mean Sam Shanklin said on the live broadcast yesterday that it takes like 20 minutes to learn to defend this, but it takes actually much more to learn how to win it from the Philidor position. And to date, I have no idea how to win it. I've learned it before and I couldn't remember. I probably would spend hours trying to remember it. I just feel that it's a funny example because I actually have gotten like 3 rook and bishop against rooks in my lifetime. But it's fair to say that you generally don't get that sort of positions anyway. So, and also I think that my opinion on, say, pawn endings, which happens, I think, the most often as well as rook endings. Pawn endings is all about calculation, in my opinion. Right. Okay, you need to know some basic concepts like triangulation, you know, zugzwang, opposition, you know, this sort of thing. But on top of that, all the endings that I've encountered in my lifetime are all extremely concrete, and being a better calculator tends to get a better result. So I feel like working on calculation is actually more important, not just tactics. I think calculation is actually the ability to visualize moves and also calculation technique is important. Okay. So that would be my emphasis for players who want to reach, say, master level, say 2300 or 2400. I think working on calculation is definitely one of the best things you can do. And then the next thing is to look at openings. I'm sure that there are a lot of old school cultured chess grandmasters out there who will say that what I'm saying is just rubbish. But
yeah,
it's just the approach that I've used and it has worked for me. So.
And what about in terms of how to allocate the time? So if our emphasis is primarily openings and calculation, you being at a higher level mentioned for 6 hours of openings and 2 hours of calculation, but I'm guessing for lower rated players, you would skew that, or like how would you divide, say, 10 hours a week of prep time, study time?
If it's 10 hours a week, then I would equally apportion the time to looking at calculation openings and then going through some useful meter games. So that collection of classics would be useful, because we should not forget that part of the game as well. So the ability to understand the essence of the position and not make silly position errors, I think, is also quite important. So that would actually be my recommendation to. I know that I'm sort of contradicting myself to now we go and look at the Botvinnik or right. or Karpov, but I think at every single level you should be looking at some of these world champion games, and if you are short of time, I would recommend Tigran Petrosian or Anatoly Karpov, because I think Petrosian is well known for his defensive abilities. Yeah, I think.
Yeah.
So people can attack easily. I think it's a joy to attack, and it's kind of easy to attack, right? Like to come out with a mating attack and this sort of thing. But it's a lot more unpleasant to defend, and it's a very important skill.
Okay, good advice. And what about book or resource recommendations? You mentioned Secrets of Spectacular Chess, and you mentioned, of course, Chess Mood, your friend Avtek Gregorian's site. What else should people, what other recommendations do you find yourself giving?
Yeah, I really like this book, and it's kind of very obscure, I think. It's called Positioner Sacrifices by Neil McDonough. There's another book that's named exactly the same. I think it was written by Mihail Suba. But the McDonough book it really opened my eyes up to the fact that chess has so many different possibilities.
Okay.
So it has many different sections. So as the name suggests, it contains many examples where one side sacrifices material for seemingly innocuous gains. So the game that made the most impression from the book, and I still remember it, is between Karpov and Gelfand. And Black had the bishop on b7. White had the queen on c4 and a pawn on e4 and a rook on d1, and then we have a bunch of other pieces on the board. And Karpov played rook d1 to d5. And it just struck me that I think that there will be very few players who are, say, below 2300 who will ever even consider a move like this. Because we are taught at the young age that's the value to every single piece, and that we are trained to be materialistic in some extent. And if you want to sacrifice material, you need to win the game eventually. Like it has to mate, or you don't sacrifice material. So to give away a whole exchange for just positional compensation was really alien to me. And that is really the first book that I recommend to many of my friends as well. I think it helped me appreciate the game a lot more.
Good, yeah. And I know for adults, as you mentioned, and myself included, that is, it's a hard habit to break because it feels hardwired, the materialism, the as Jonathan Rowson called it, the anchoring of the point values, even though in reality we might know intellectually that the point values can be much more dynamic, but it's hard to over the board to think about that. So it sounds like a good recommendation.
It's really hard, and to me it was really strange that when I showed a sacrifice to a friend and then I just say that, look, the compensation is really obvious, right? And then he would say no. And then I would think, why is he thinking like that? And I understood that it's just because that he's not exposed to that sort of element before, and that's why he's thinking in that way. So I feel that it's important to it's important to train to be a better player, I think it's even more important to do something in chess that helps you appreciate the game a lot more, because it gives you more motivation. Because I don't know about going through like tactics, solving puzzles over and over again. At some point, it's going to be boring. I think like you have to train in a way that helps you enjoy the game more, or else you just lose the motivation.
Yeah, definitely true. Yeah, calculation, I mean, it's hard because you don't get immediate benefits. That's one thing I've, over the years, I've been less of an advocate for opening study than you have, it's fair to say. But in terms, I recently read Willie Hendricks' new book on the origin of good moves, and I had him on the show, and he also advocates as that people who are kind of at a plateau or near their peak in particular, studying openings can be a good way to still improve your chess. And as I get back into studying, I just find that when I study openings, I get something tangible. You know, it's like, especially shout out to Chessable, of course, who sponsors the show. But like, I just see the improvement. It's, you know, I didn't know this a week ago and I know it now. Whereas when you do calculation training, it might be helping, but it's not, unless you're doing you know, there's this puzzle rush experiment that Elijah Logazar, a recent guest, has people doing hours a day. Like, I think if you do hours a day, maybe you'd get better over some period. But for people who have less time, it can be hard to see the reward, even if you're putting the time in.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even know if there's, you know, if it's proven that, you know, repeating. I know there's this book called The Woodpecker
Method. The Woodpecker Method, yeah.
And then he was advocating something like repeating puzzles over a certain period of time and then trying to shorten the period of time to solve all these puzzles and trying to get a higher score every single time. Intuitively, it just doesn't feel right. It doesn't feel like the right way to train.
Uh-huh.
But it worked apparently for Hans Tikkanen, I think it was him,
yeah,
and Axel Smith. So it worked for them. I think they scored good results after that. But just intuitively, it just feels like a very strange way to train. And it doesn't sound like a fun way to train as well.
I agree with that. Yeah, I did a whole show about the Woodpecker Method with a friend of the show, Neil Bruce, and a lot of people online are really digging in right now. So, and the other thing is, I mentioned this somewhere, but friend of the show, Christopher Chabris, who's actually a cognitive scientist and has mentioned sort of the you know, the scientific grounding of spaced repetition generally is well founded, but we don't know. Like, okay, it helps you learn openings, it helps you learn language, but if you memorize some pattern, a checkmate pattern, does that help your calculation, or do you just know that one pattern? So I feel like that's sort of the questions that we don't have the answers to, and I'm going to have Chris back on in a few weeks and try to pick his brain a little bit. But honestly, I think even for the cognitive scientists in the world, we just don't know yet. So
yeah, I think that there's very little evidence that, at least to my knowledge, so happy to be corrected, but at least with my conversations to some friends, mostly IMs and GMs, they not only have they never heard of this method, they don't believe in it. But I mean, okay, if it has worked for some other players, yeah, it means there must be some positive to it. And I also want to briefly talk about the bit about, I think you mentioned about spaced repetition and openings.
Yeah.
I think it's important to repeat, definitely to repeat the moves of lines that you have studied, but overdoing it it could be counterproductive.
Yeah.
Because it's just not a good way to memorize openings, unless you are doing this like Caruana, doing this 30 moves lines in this comp, and they already have eidetic memories and they are used to this sort of thing. But for people like you and me, you know, we are just normal people, it's just not doable. And it's really more important to understand the key ideas and to play openings that you like and you sort of have a good sense of. So even if you don't remember the lines, you can work things out over the board. And I think that's more important than just, you know, doing this spaced repetition thing over and over again. I'm not really sure that that's a good way to study openings.
Yeah, it's a good point. I've been quoting this Alex Yermolinsky. I recently reread The Road to Chess Improvement, and he says,
"Yeah, that's a good book. I have it."
Yeah, and he says, "Never learn an opening move if you don't understand why it's played." Like, yeah. So you might see some move, but if you don't know the context, and I've been struggling with that because I'm trying to brush up on my repertoire, and you know, not everything is explained, and then you have to tinker around with the engine until you sort of feel like, I mean, obviously you could just think about it too and maybe figure it out, but but more likely I'm going to get the answer from the engine. And sometimes it involves some trial and error, and that can take some time. So if you're feeling like you're trying to get through this puzzle set sort of thing, problem set or a repertoire set, it can feel like it's not productive, but actually it is, to actually know why you're playing the move. Because then, yeah, as you say, if you're not remembering, you'll be able to generate the thought process, or at least you have a fighting chance.
Yeah, it's actually extremely relevant, because there are many occasions when, you know, the opponent will just make a small sidestep to the line that you have been memorizing, and then you just realize that this is not something that you have.
Yeah, you want to tell them, hey,
repeat.
Yeah, that's not the right move. Could you play the right move so that I know what to do? Yeah,
it's like, dude, you got this wrong. Like, do you want to correct this? Yeah. But yeah, I think that you're absolutely right. I think that it's really important to understand the move orders at the very start. It helps you appreciate the game more as well, I think. So I was trying to understand this Rosolimo stuff. To give you a concrete example, I think the line that in game one of Caruana Carlsen, so where white goes bishop b5, bishop takes c6, dc6, and this whole line with black going knight to f6 to d7 to f8. Mm-hmm. And it took me a while to really understand the move orders. And eventually I did. And then I never forgot. I've never forgotten the line after that in Blitz. Like, I could remember every single aspect of the line, and at which point do I play, for instance, when white goes f2 to f4, I have a pawn on e5, and he goes f2 to f4, the typical pawn break, and after e takes f4, he can capture with the knight or with the bishop. Sorry, with the rook or with the bishop, and in one case, you respond with knight to e6, and the other, you respond with bishop to e6. If you memorize this, you're just going to forget 1 month down the road. You have to understand it.
Yeah.
So I think this is actually one of the greatest examples I could think of. You just need to understand the point of the position, and then it's just a lot more easier. I think that in very, very concrete and specific positions, you might need to memorize certain moves, but those should be the exception. It should not be the norm.
Okay. Excellent advice. All right. Well, Kevin, this has been amazing. I have at least one more question for you. From your friend Andrei Tarakov, FM Andrei Tarakov, Chessable author who put us in touch. So I appreciate that Andrei did that. This has been a really enlightening interview. So he asks you, he says, you spent the last 10 years chasing the dream of becoming a grandmaster. Now that you have achieved it, what's your next goal?
Yeah, I think that firstly, the fact that I struggled so hard to break the 2500 level, like my rating is not 2501. It's not, you know, it's not be way above 2500. I just barely made it. It probably means that I'm not really a 2500 player. So for instance, there are many players who have crossed the 2400 mark and then they immediately drop back to 2350, 2360. And that probably means that they are not consistent 2400 players. And I was there at one point, and I think I'm exactly now at the 2500 level. The fact that I struggled so hard to get here probably means that I'm not at this level. That's my own evaluation or assessment of my chess playing ability. And I would like to fix that. I would like to be consistent in terms of playing at the a reasonable grandmaster level in the tournaments to come. So I still want to train. I want to get better. Obviously, the pressure is off.
Right.
I no longer need to go for GM events. I can actually play in, you know, nice open in nice cities.
Yeah.
The guys from Novi Sad will kill me, but they know what I mean. I mean, I'm sure they agree that,
you know. Well, they provide a great service. I mean, it should be clear, yeah, because I mean, people work so hard to get their titles, and if you just go to like Aeroflot Open or the Isle of Man tournament, I mean, they're great tournaments, but there's so much in those big Swisses is out of your hands in terms of getting a norm. So
yeah, I would like to be able to, you know, play chess at a good level and just enjoy it without, you know, calculating performance rating every single round.
Right.
So, So I think that's the first step. I think the bigger goal for me is to really consider how I can contribute towards the young players. I think I have a lot of experience to share. I think many young players are a lot more talented than myself. I'm not ashamed in sharing this, that there are so many talented players that are more talented than I am, and that they just need some guidance and to somebody to point them in the right direction. And I think I can do that for them. I don't claim to know everything, but obviously I've gone through some of these struggles. I kind of know what I think would be good advice. And that's something that I'm looking at in the foreseeable future.
That's great. And I guess, first of all, I'm glad to hear that you're going to keep playing competitively, even after this long journey. And I guess you were planning on playing the Olympiad probably before. Were you going to make time for that before COVID came?
I took time off. I took leave already for the event. And now FIDE just announced the FIDE online chess Olympiad. So I've submitted a request to the federation that we should be sending the team. There's no reason not to send the team at all for this online event. I still want to improve. I think I still want to learn more about chess. I could not possibly go back to the same kind of intensity. Like I was when I was preparing for Serbia, but I will still work on chess. I think it's important that if you are serious about chess, you should be looking at some chess every single day, no matter how tired you are after a hard day's work. You should be logging on to whichever website, chess24 or chess.com, and you look at some live broadcast to just listen to some of these great players and their commentary and just be involved in chess in some way. Because I don't think you should use. I mean, if you're really serious about chess, then putting in the extra effort should not be that big a problem. You're not even spending time to solve a puzzle. You're just watching live commentary from strong players. How hard could that be, right? So there's no excuse. Like, if you really want to be good at chess, you should be touching chess every single day.
That's great advice. And okay, one more. Any parting advice for anyone stuck at a plateau? I mean, that's something that obviously you have a lot of experience with, having been through so many ups and downs.
Yeah, I'm very familiar with with stagnating, with choking. Right. So I think that the best advice I could give is the one that I got from Jacob Agard. That's not how the way we should pronounce his name, but I'm not going to attempt it. I asked him that, I think back that was in 2017, that I made my 2GM norms in 2012, and since then I've not made any progress in any way whatsoever. And he just said that if you have been doing the same way, getting progress using a particular way doesn't mean that it works every single time.
Right.
So the fact that I've stagnated means that way is no longer working. So it's time to do something else. So that was the one thing that he said. And what that exact thing is, consult somebody better than you.
Okay. So what did you change when you got that advice?
Yeah. So I switched. I focused a lot more on calculation. So we're coming up with the same topic that we spoke of earlier. So I think it's not just about solving puzzles anymore. It's about calculation techniques.
Mm-hmm.
So again, I have Avitik Grigoryan to thank for this. So he gave me very concrete examples that requires a lot of that causes a lot of stress and strain because it requires you to visualize the position very, very deeply, 6 to 7 moves into the position. And it's not just about tactics, it's about seeing possibilities. It's about having the right calculation technique. Like, we even worked out the 4-step process in certain positions. So I'm not sure I'm making any sense here. I'm kind of rambling a little bit. But basically, I focus a lot more on calculation as compared to the past. In especially calculation technique.
Okay.
So at some point, he wasn't interested in whether I'm getting the positions or I'm getting the right answer. He's more concerned with the process. So he'll be asking me things like, so this is position A. Now you're at position X. If you mess it up, do you go back to position A? Like, do you start from the beginning? Because if you are, you're not improving.
Hmm.
You should have an anchor somewhere in between, and then you work backwards slowly from there. So it's kind of abstract. It's hard to
explain. It's high level advice, but I mean, if anyone's doing any sort of blindfold training, that's useful, you know?
Yeah, blindfold training definitely works. It's just difficult. It's just so tedious and daunting that people don't do it for good reason.
Right. Okay, well, Kevin, this has been amazing. Thank you. I think there's a lot to learn from this, so I really appreciate it. And plus, your story is just inspiring on its own. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Ben. It's been my pleasure. This is I think I've never shared so deeply about the entire journey to anybody. So I think, I'm very happy to share my experience, and I'm happy to even follow up with any questions that anybody might have.
Sure. I'm sure a few people will take you up on that. So I know you're on Twitter. Do you share your email address? Are you on Facebook? What's the best way for people to keep up with any future charity initiatives?
You can use my email. Should I say it out?
I'll just put it in the show notes if it's okay.
So you can reach me by email, on Facebook, or on Twitter. I don't use Twitter that often. Not as flamboyant as our friend Olympio, I'm generally quite accessible.
Excellent. All right. Well, thanks.
Platforms.
Thank you so much, and congratulations again. It's really incredible. I'm glad you made it after all that hard work.
Yeah, me too.
Okay, and thanks for staying up late, Kevin. Have a good night.
No, thanks. It's been fun.
Okay.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Special thanks, as always, to my producer, Matthew Passy, and thanks to those who continue to help spread the word about Perpetual Chess. Positive reviews on podcast platforms and YouTube help people discover the show, as does telling a friend or sharing it on social media. Speaking of which, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at BennyFischel1, or join the Perpetual Chess Facebook group and continue the conversation about the latest interview. But most of all, of course, I want to thank those who provide financial support to the show, especially right now with so much disruption going on in the world. Most of all, I want to thank Chessable for sponsoring the show, and to everyone who kicks in via PayPal or the Perpetual Chess Patreon page to help sustain and improve Perpetual Chess. And without further ado, I would like to give special thanks to the following people and entities: Chessable, Quality Chess Books, the Capital City Chess Club, a Print Chess Twitch channel, Andrew Alharjri, Andrew Bach, Austin Clough, Benjamin Porteau, Bill Sigler, Kathy Carr, Chad Oliver, Chris Flanagan, Dan O'Hanlon, Danny Davidson, David Shriver, I am Dimitri Schneider, I am Eric Rosen, Faraz Sawaf, Gary Foreman, Greg Natel, Greg Shahadi, Guven Manet, James Kennedy, Jens Green, John Jernigan, John Rockefeller, John Cromarty, John MacArthur, Kelly Palmer, Kevin O'Callaghan, Lucio Casada Silva, the Law Offices of Stuart Katz, Michael Kahn, FM Michael Oblin, Mike Zelazny, Moonmaster 9000, you recently stopped your pledge, but Perpetual Chess will always love you. The famous Mr. Dodgy, Peter Zhody, Reuven Fisher, Seattle Chess Club, Thomas Stonix, Thomas Tachenko, Todd Bryan of Strong Chess, Todd Kennedy, and I also would like to thank the following people: Aaron Waffler, Ace Viega, Adam Ralph of ChessEngland.com, Adrian Gutierrez, Alex Pejas, FM Andre Tarakov, Dr. Andrew Perry, Aniti Deer, Better Chess Training, Bill Juniper, Bill Moran, Brad and Andy Rosen, Brett Howard Lynn, Brian Mullis, Chad Hilton, Dr. Charles Snodgrass, Chris Wainscott, Christopher Baumgartner, Christopher Shabri, Chris Lott, Christopher Wood, I am Christoph Zalecki, aka Chess Explained, Coach J's Chess Academy, Costa Carras, Courtney Fry, Craig Mollen, Daniel Gell, Daniel Ginsberg, Daniel Lucas of US Chess, Daniel Naylor, Dave Saylor, David Blaskacek, David Cramley of Chessable.com, Dalen Shelton, Dirk Decker, Dwayne Edmonds, Ed Daly, Ethan Smith, Ian Mason, I am Elect, Donnie Ariel, or possible not I am Elect, Fox Valley Chess Club, Francis Letart Lavoie, Frank Tortoris, MD, Gary Andrews, Gary Lewis, Geert Vandervoet, Gerard Barta, Giovanni Russo, Greg Harfst, Han Schut, Harish Srinivasan, Jacob Kovach, Jacques Pari, James Aspinwall, James Banastia, James Murr, Jason Woolham, Jaydeep Chakrabarty, Jeff Anderson, Jeffrey Martello, Yep Holland, Jerry Wells, Jim Ratliff, JJ Schnad, Dr. John Fallon, John Fernandez, John Fontaine, John Hartman, John Jeffrey, John McMurtry, Jonathan Slater, Jordan Goodwin, Jose Rodriguez, Justin Gardner, Jen Shahadi, Joe Rocky, John Thompson, Grandmaster Josh Friedel, IM Kare Christensen, WGM Katerina Nemsova, Kelly Palmer, IM Kostya Kovutsky, Krishna Kapala Krishnan, Kyle McAvoy, Larry Reiforth, Laura Belyavsky, Martin Knudsen, Martin Krug, Matthew Passy, Matthew Tedesco of SeattleChessMeetup.org, the Mechanics Institute Chess Club of San Francisco, Michael Allard, Miguel Arispedi, Mike Clem, Mr. Mike Shahadi, Mitchell Fabian, Nate Solin, Neil Bruce, Negmat Malajanov, Olaf Mueller-Michaels, GM Pascal Charbonneau, Pasi Passanen, Paul Bain, Paul Clarkson, Paul Sweeney, Paulo Santana, Peter Lux, Randall Temple, Ricky Grijalva, Richard Hollenbuck, Robert Turner, Roy Yearwood, Ryan Berg, the Say Chess YouTube channel, Scott Daugherty, Scott McKinnon, Sebastian Finsterwalder, Stefan Roller, WGM Tatyav Abrahamian, Tim Brennan of TacticsTime.com, Tim Seymour, Timothy Ha, Tom Edsel, Tomas Komanich, Tony Rotella, Tyron Price, Vishnu Srikumar, Wayne Beam, William Brock, William Juniper, William Hogarth, William Peterson, FM Zhao Cheng of Chess1000.com, and last but never least, Zivko Stoyanov. Thanks for listening, everyone. Catch you guys soon.
Podcast Network.
It's time for today's Lucky Land horoscope with Victoria Cash.
Life's gotten mundane, so shake up the daily routine and be adventurous with a trip to Lucky Land. You know what they say, your chance to win starts with a spin. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com to play over 100 social casino-style games for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void or prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.